Hello and welcome to the Provider Wellness Podcast. I'm Matthew Zinder, a certified registered nurse anesthetist. I'm an advanced practice nurse that specializes in the practice of anesthesia. The scope of this podcast will explore healthcare provider health and wellness from the broad to the specific. My aim is to educate while offering a unique perspective. Thank you for joining me today, and let's get right to the show. Hey folks, I hope everyone is well. Well, once again, there has been quite a break since my last upload, and I do apologize for that. I do appreciate all of the inquiries asking when the next upload will be. But, you know, sometimes this has to fall to the back burner as it is a voluntary project. Luckily, we do have a great episode today. In this episode, I have a conversation with Dr. Amir Rashidian. He is a chiropractor and an author on two books about stress and the stress response. He owns a practice here in my home state of Maryland, and we have a discussion about chiropractic care, the benefits, both well-known and not well-known, and also the misconceptions that surround this practice. We discuss how the central nervous system affects all aspects of health and wellness and how chiropractic care can affect this notion. Dr. Rashidian also discusses his books and how the stress response affects a person's overall health. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Now, as always, please keep checking back for future episodes. I have many planned that will be covering many important topics in health and wellness. All previous episodes are available at providerwellnesspodcast.com. And remember, this show is available on all podcast platforms, so please subscribe and share the episodes. If you wish to email me with any feedback or suggestions for future shows, please do so at providerwellnesspodcast@gmail.com. And finally, as I always do, I'd like to mention the national meeting I'm involved with called the Provider Wellness Symposium. Please go to providersymposium.com for more information about this important event where healthcare providers are enabled and empowered to engage in self-care. For those who take care of others, it is time to take care of yourselves. Again, go to providersymposium.com for more information. So without further delay, here is my discussion with Dr. Amir Rashidian. All right, Dr. Rashidian, thank you so much for joining me today. I really do appreciate your time. And as I always do with these episodes, is I ask my guests to give a background on themselves, and then we can get into a conversation.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I'm happy to be here with you and your great audience. You know, my to give you enough of a background so you know why and who I am. I was 9 years old. We were traveling through these remote villages in Iran with my father, and a woman went into labor, and she was in tremendous amount of pain, and no one knew what to do. Now, in this village, there were no doctors, no hospitals. So a midwife walked over, knelt down, examined her for a minute, stood up, said, "I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. There's no heartbeat. She's not going to make it." And she had actually left her alone. And everybody had gathered around, just walked away. And at the age of 9, I'm looking into the eyes of this really young lady who's just told she's not going to live another few hours. And I had this massive panic attack where your chest feels tight, your heart's pounding, you're trying to catch your breath, and tears were starting to come down my face. And my dad saw me, picked me up, he held me, he carried me out of there, he calmed me down. And the two of us climbed down the mountain. We got in our car to drive home. And I said, "Dad, I don't want to feel like that ever again." "Like what?" "You know, helpless. There's nothing I can do to help." And he said, "What are you going to do about it?" I said, "Well, let me go be a surgeon. I'll be the best surgeon in the whole world, carry my medical bag with me everywhere I go. I'll just save lives." And 10 years later, I was a student at George Washington and went home for Christmas break. And Dad had a big, thick, white neck brace on. You could tell he was high on some serious painkillers. He had pain shooting down both arms, numbness, weakness in his hands. He couldn't lift his arms to even give me a hug to say hello. And so we started on this journey over the next few weeks, going from doctor to doctor, trying to figure out what's wrong with Dad. Every doctor we went to said, "You have to go to this other doctor." And eventually we ended up in a neurosurgeon's office who said, "You needed surgery yesterday." He said, "We're going to break and remove the bones in the back of the spine to take pressure off the spinal cord. And then we're going to put rods and screws on the sides, fuse your whole neck. You'll never turn your head again, and you may not regain function of your hands. But we're hoping you have less pain. And there's a chance you're going to die because you're old." Dad was 70 at the time. And so we got in a taxi to go home. We actually met with three neurosurgeons. We got in a taxi to go home. And the back of the taxi, I was carrying all of Dad's x-rays, MRIs, CTs, medical records. And I looked over at my dad, and he was cringing because I could tell every bump that taxi hit was sending a lightning bolt of pain through his entire body. Looking in his eyes, I could tell he wanted to die. And I started to have that same emotion, that same feeling when I'm in that room in the village, watching that woman slowly pass away in her husband's arms. And I'm feeling the same helplessness that I never wanted to feel again. So as I'm starting to get teary-eyed, this taxi driver looked at Dad and I in his rearview mirror, and he said, "Sir, I noticed you're in a lot of pain, and I know you asked me to take you home, but there's a chiropractor right down the street, and I've heard he can help people like you. Would you like me to take you there?" So Dad was terrified of surgery. I believe the only way to help anybody is drugs and surgery. Dad didn't want to do it. So he said, sure. And we end up in this chiropractor's office. Long story short, the chiropractor said, if you give me 6 months and you need to be here 6 days a week for those 6 months, I can make you better. This is not going to be easy and it's probably going to be painful. Dad agreed and he did it. And 6 months later, he had full use of his hands. He could turn his head. Pain was gone. He lived to be 88 years old. At 88, he was younger than when he was 70. He actually lived long enough to be my best man when I got married. He lived long enough to meet my first son when he was born. So I decided I would become a chiropractor instead of a surgeon and work on preventing disease and hopefully keeping people away from being dependent on long-term medication. And that's the background now. So I've been a chiropractor for 23 years now. Went to National University of Health Sciences in Chicago, and I own two offices. We're a team of three doctors, 12, probably not 15 staff members, and we're making an impact. I think we're doing a good job and getting a lot of people better. I did write two books. The first one was called The Stress-Proof Life. The second one that came out last October is called Cracking the Stress Secret: How to Turn Pressure into Power. And I know, Matthew, you are a huge expert when it comes to stress and stress management. So I'm expecting this to be a really great conversation.
I've been looking forward to it as well. And there's a lot of roads to go down from that amazing background that you just described, starting with that childhood story, which was very powerful. So, let's start with maybe a little bit of the, talk about the profession, because I'm very curious about how one describes, like, in other words, if a person comes up to you now, actually, before I even ask this question, I go to a chiropractor. Okay. I believe in it. I mean, I apologize for even saying that. I believe in it, but that's kind of the road I want to go down with you, because there's a lot of skepticism about the profession, is there not? So if there's a person that were to come up to you and you at the cocktail party conversation, and you tell them what you do and go down the road, well, I was going to be a surgeon, you tell your story, and a person might say, well, chiropractic, oh man, that you do this, that's scary, don't you hurt more people than you help, or any of the above answers. How do you respond in that regard? Like even someone, because I've had this conversation with before, because I recommend my chiropractor all over, because he's done wonders for me. But then I've literally heard someone say, oh, quackery, they use that word, So how do you go down that road? And probably because I personally would probably feel rather frustrated when you go down that road. One of the things that proves validity is the fact that insurance pays for it, and go down, you can talk about that. But when, like, the elevator pitch, or if a person says to you something like that, or even tell me what you do, how do you address that? Because I think it's probably something, because I, what I do also, I nurse anesthesia. Nobody knows what a CRNA is. Everybody thinks that when you get put to sleep, it's always by an anesthesiologist, and I'm always describing what I do as well. But how do you address that, especially to a skeptic?
Okay. So there's probably a few questions in that one question. One is the safety. One is efficacy. And certainly the other is, what is it? What is chiropractic? So let's start with that one first. What is it? And if someone says, I've never experienced it, I have no idea what it is, tell me what chiropractic is, because all I know is you snap bones into place, and that doesn't seem very safe. So traditional chiropractic is very different than what it turned out to be. See, back in the, I think it was the 1950s, the AMA formed a committee. It was a secret committee called the Committee Against Quackery. And their goal was to put chiropractors out of business. Now, that ended up in an antitrust lawsuit that in 1989 was ruled by the Supreme Court of the United States in favor of chiropractors. So ACA went up against the AMA. This is David and Goliath. AMA had billions of dollars in legal funds. ACA had barely scrounged together $1 million, but they won. And then the AMA and a lot of other organizations underneath the AMA settled for an undisclosed amount outside. So until 1989, it was illegal for medical doctors and chiropractors to work together or co-manage a patient. So we are the youngest field in healthcare. We've already become the second largest field in healthcare. So outside of medicine, chiropractic is the largest, and it grew that fast. I think that speaks a bit about efficacy and safety. But so what is it? And if you ask me that, I'll tell you what the original chiropractic was, not what today's chiropractic is. Because what happened is in the 80s, a group of orthopedic surgeons formed Blue Cross Blue Shield. They said, we can't shut down the chiropractors. We might as well try to box them into this thing called musculoskeletal issues. And so they said, as long as you become back pain and neck pain doctors, we will reimburse you for chiropractic care. And then other insurances pursued, and Medicare accepts chiropractic and reimburses for it. And also President George Bush signed the law that said there has to be a chiropractor on every military base by the year 2010. That never happened. But that was an actual executive order, which became came to pass because a lot of fighter pilots in the Air Force were hurting themselves because of the G-forces. So it would cost millions of dollars to train these fighter pilots, and their back pain would start 5 years into their training, and then they had to retire early. Those who were under chiropractic care could continue to work for 20 plus years. Now, what is chiropractic? Originally, truly chiropractic was based on one premise. This is a philosophical statement, so I can't prove it's correct or wrong. But the premise is that the human body is self-healing and self-regulating. So now that philosophy, I can prove it in certain ways. For example, if I break a bone, all you do is immobilize it and the bone grows back together so it can repair itself. The other bones in your body don't grow, just the one that broke. So there is an innate wisdom inside of us. If you cut my hand, it will heal. I may need stitches to put the edges together and hold it in place, but it repairs itself. If I cut a piece of steak and throw it in the corner of the room, it doesn't heal. So there's this life force, and we believe that life force is connected to the brain. So the short of it is, premise number one, human body is self-healing, self-regulating. You need an enzyme, you produce it. You need hormones, you produce it. Why do opioids work? Because we have opioid receptors in our body. Well, that means we can produce opioids. That's what endorphins are and enkephalins are. So we can produce those things in certain situations. Most drugs are based on what the body can already produce anyways, and that's why those receptors can be activated or blocked. And so human body can self-regulate. Everything's connected to the brain. There's a nerve that goes from the brain to every cell, every tissue, every organ in the body. We do, in chiropractic school, we do 4 semesters of gross anatomy. We dissect the entire body and we trace every nerve from the brain down the spine out to all the organs. So that's a fact. Anatomically, it's been proven. Physiologically, it's been proven. If there is no interference in that system of nerves, your body should function properly. If something interferes with one of those nerves, then the body will act up. It will do something different. It will not be able to self-heal and self-regulate. And that's what can lead to disease. I'm not saying every disease is because of that. And I'm not saying every illness is because of nerve interference. But I do know for a fact that interfering with the nerve to the liver can affect liver function, and the nerve to the heart can affect heart function. That's why we have 2 separate nerves that go to our heart. And so the job of the chiropractor is detect that interference and remove it, thereby restoring the body to its proper function.
That is a great description. I mean, I love what you're talking about because it goes right into my wheelhouse of interest. And that is the fact that in only certain circumstances is the body wired for self-repair. And that's kind of when I start to talk about in a lot of my talks with, you know, like stress management for healthcare providers, I get into, look, we have to reframe this concept of stress and what the stress response is truly for. And only in certain circumstances is the body hardwired for self-repair, and that is parasympathetic. Where are we spending most of our time? We're stressed out. We're activating the sympathetic response. That's why we're seeing negative health outcomes. So you're speaking to my interest area. That is that is true. Now, when it comes to things like the manipulation, because it's probably a little bit where I guess where people get a little scared, you know, when you, for lack of a better way to put it, you know, people call it, well, cracking, or, you know, cracking of the bones to realign them. How do you kind of address that if a person comes like and discusses it with you? I'm anxious about, you know, cracking my neck or something like that. I mean, how do you address that?
Well, the first thing I'll tell them is there's low force techniques we can use that have proven to be just as effective. So if you absolutely don't want the sound of the adjustment, and that's really because I do believe if it creates a negative response in your body, let's say that sound of that adjustment sends you further into sympathetics. Now we're counteracting what we were hoping to do. If parasympathetic is where we want to be, we know that every misalignment in the spine has a sympathetic component to it, but there are certain adjustments that boost that parasympathetic response, like anterior cervical adjustments, flexion thoracic adjustments, counter-nutation of the sacrum. Coming back to what you just asked, is it safe? Well, the number one thing that you cannot dispute is that there's this thing called malpractice insurance. You have malpractice insurance, and so do I. And in fact, you own a large organization with doctors and other CRNAs, which means your malpractice has to cover you and all of them. So I can tell you the general medical practitioner, primary care physician's malpractice insurance, last I heard, was somewhere around $18,000 a year to cover them for malpractice. I have a half brother who's an OBGYN. He pays well over $100,000 annually to be covered for $3 million of malpractice. I own the organization. My malpractice covers me and the other doctors and the staff on the team. I pay $1,000 annually for malpractice for $3 million coverage, which means chiropractors don't get sued. Now, there is one thing that the most common lawsuit for chiropractors is actually sexual misconduct, because patients will misinterpret the touch. And so you really have to explain what you're doing before you do it and approach it that way. Another level of safety is, unfortunately, there are different techniques in chiropractic. And so different chiropractors approach things very differently. My technique is based on X-ray. I don't believe you should move bones around inside someone's body unless you have analyzed it digitally, drawn lines, made measurements, and you know exactly which bone is how far out of alignment. You also need to see, we could X-ray a dead person and put the image next to an X-ray of a live person, and I wouldn't know if one is dead, one is alive, because the X-ray looks the same. So you have to combine that with motion studies. You have to combine that with surface electromyograms and thermal scans that represent blood flow around the brain. And then we also do a special type of heart rate variability that actually tell us if your body at rest stays in fight or flight, or if you're balanced, or you're approaching adrenal fatigue, which means you've been in a stress state so long that now you're exhausted. So all of those tests need to be put into place. If, let's say, the C1, the first bone in the neck, which the X-ray would be through the mouth and from the side, we need to measure the angle from the side as an example. The angle of the atlas needs to be 14 degrees. So if that angle is less than 14, we know it affects blood flow to the brain and the brainstem, and it will cause things like ADD, ADHD, sleep apnea, insomnia, depression, anxiety, mood swings, along with headaches, migraines, dizziness, lightheadedness. And so our goal would be, okay, we got the X-ray, we make the measurements. Let's say it's tilted to the right, angled down, you know, not 14 degrees, let's say it's 12 degrees. Okay, how would we put that back? We design a plan, we put it back where it's supposed to be through multiple adjustments. Then you have to do a post X-ray and measure it again and show that you changed what you needed to do. The scans should clear up, the nerves should start firing properly, the heart rate variability should come out of fight or flight, and on X-ray, that angle should be over 14 degrees again. That's how we ensure safety. Because right. Now, if I go in blind, then I don't know what that atlas looks like. I mean, I can feel it with my fingers, and chiropractors are very skilled. We can feel a whole lot with our fingers, but it's never 100% accurate. And so I just like to see which bone I'm adjusting and design that plan and do those post x-rays.
And do you, I'm sure there's a technical word for this as far as the manipulation. Do you do the cracking or, yes. Cause I know there, you do. Okay. Cause there are other chiropractors that will not do the cracking, but use what I affectionately call the clicker, but I know they call it the activator.
Yes.
And muscle manipulation.
Yes.
Do you also use techniques like that or a combination?
Yeah, we also use Thompson drop technique, which is very non-invasive as well. The activator is a very powerful device. But the reason I call it the activator is because it activates the proprioceptive nerves and proprioceptive receptors, which tell the brain, move this bone. So it's not actually moving the bone for you. It just activates the part of the brain and a very specific impulse to that joint. I think all manipulation for the most part does that. Chiropractors don't like the term manipulation. They like the term adjustment because we want it to be more precise and more specific. But really, I mean, if let's say C2 is rotated to the right, I can adjust it with my hand and put it back into place, or I can use the activator or the clicker. Or we can do motion techniques where I'll hold that in place and I'll have you turn your head till it's tender and eventually it stops being tender. And I know that bone is going back into place. One of the analogies inventor of some of these techniques talked about was you can walk up to a yacht in water and kick it and the yacht won't move. But you can put your finger on the bow of that yacht and apply gentle pressure and it'll start to float away from you. So clearly you those low force techniques are extremely effective, and I've seen phenomenal changes on pre and post x-rays even with that.
I like that you use x-rays because I'm big on that as well. Like you want to know what you're working on. You want to know, and it does make sense though, that if for a provider that doesn't necessarily use x-rays, they're such experts on the anatomy back there that if they're assessing with their fingers and addressing the complaint or the history of that patient, it could be close to the same, but imaging is imaging. All right. So, I definitely, that makes sense. Do you have your, I mean, this is just curiosity. Do you have your own, imaging facility?
Yes,
you do. Yeah. Cause yeah, that's
both,
one of the other things.
Offices have x-ray.
Yeah. That's good. Cause it's like, that's the other thing. It's like these in this day and age, you know, go get imaging. Oh, okay. Well, next month I can get it at, the facility. So, so when it comes to the common understanding of what chiropractic does, it's, you know, I think the common understanding is, well, you know, I have back pain. I'm going to go see a chiropractor. Can you speak to what's, and I think you've touched on this already a little bit, but can you speak to specifically what other health benefits can chiropractic assist with?
Absolutely. So very interesting. Let's take that gentleman who is having back pain. When you dig deep into their history, you'll also find out that they have some bloating and gas or maybe constipation as well. Well, we know that the L3 nerve, which is the third lumbar vertebra, can affect the L3 nerve, which a branch of it can affect the valve between the small and the large intestine, which leads to bloating. So we've seen tremendous amount of times where patients will come in because of back pain, we'll adjust that L3 vertebra, put it back in place, back pain goes away, but then they go, hey, my bowels are working better. Another great example is we see a lot of ladies with painful menstrual cramps, heavy flow, irregular cycles. And again, that has to do with the sacrum, the tailbone. If that angle, when you take a lateral lumbosacral view, the angle should be between 36 and 42 degrees. Now, if the lumbar curve is better, you can go up to 45 degrees. But if some of these ladies, their angle is 50, 55 degrees, which is way too high. And so we counter-nutate that sacrum, bring it down. Instantly, the menstrual cycles get better. So we have a lot of people who just come in once a month, right before they're about to have their cycle, and they get that tailbone adjusted, and their cycles are not painful. The flow is normal. And we've had at least half a dozen ladies who were dealing with infertility. After they started getting adjusted, they were able to have children.
Wow. Wow. And you would never guess that. That's not something that's commonly known. I mean, really, right. A lot of people just say, well, if my back hurts, my neck hurts, I'm going to go see the chiropractor. But there are so many other things. I mean, do you recommend that people be assessed by a chiropractor if they have a certain number of other ailments?
Yeah, so I'm kind of fanatical when it comes to this. I think chiropractic should be used like dentistry. We all have our own dentist, and we all get visited by the dentist, you know, hopefully a couple times a year, and you get your professional cleaning and so on. So I think it should be the same thing. I recommend getting spinal x-rays every 2 years, even if you're perfectly healthy and there's nothing wrong, because these are 24 moving parts in the body. Just like you get your oil changed in your car, chiropractic is that wellness maintenance. I jokingly tell my patients, come back the day before it's going to hurt. Because let's catch it and fix it. I mean, it's a lot of times it's like that avalanche. It starts at a snowball at the top, very easy to stop it there, but you don't feel anything at the top. By the time it gets to the bottom, it's this giant avalanche that's going to take out anything in front of it. But that's very difficult to stop, which is where my dad was. That's why he had to see that chiropractor 6 days a week for 6 months. I think it literally cost him $9,000 or $10,000 that he didn't have. He had to borrow just to get that care. I'm glad he did it, and it ended up being an amazing thing. But what if he had gone to those chiropractors, you know, regularly his entire life? We see newborns actually in our office. Wow. Obviously, we don't x-ray the newborns, but newborn techniques are very different. C1 only moves side to side. The rest of it goes back to front. So you're not doing any rotational manipulations on these babies, and you're not using any force whatsoever. It's gentle, sustained pressure movements. But we see a lot of children who come in because they spit up a lot or they have colic. 1, 2, 3 adjustments, you'll see their nervous system balance get better. I had one baby come in, and the parents said, you know, she's the best baby. She sleeps a lot and doesn't really cry much. But she hadn't gained weight. I said, well, this is failure to thrive, and I need to wake this nervous system up. And so we did a couple of adjustments where in this case, we actually wanted to move this baby more towards sympathetic just to stimulate things. And I said, listen, your baby's going to become normal. She's going to cry more. She's going to not sleep through the night. This is a 2-month-old baby. They shouldn't sleep through the night anyways. I mean, then I don't want to put everybody in a box. But anyways, so she started to gain weight all of a sudden and turned into a normal baby. But it's all about the nervous system and how you activate it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was actually surprising to hear that you see newborns, but that makes sense. If there's some sort of issue with the way that they were born, was that like genetics or function of birth or any of the above?
Good question. I think it was probably birth trauma.
Okay.
The delivery process can be traumatic. You know, being related to an OBGYN, I know that they turn the head and pull. Right. The average force is 20 pound feet of torque when they turn the baby's head, and 70 pounds of pull. So wow. This is a 6 to 8 pound baby being pulled that hard. It can cause misalignments. I'll give you another quick example with babies. A lot of times babies won't go to sleep unless you rock them. And the minute you stop rocking them, they actually wake up. And that is because cerebrospinal fluid is not flowing properly around the brain.
Wow.
Rocking makes that flow. That's why some people will say, I have to put the baby in the back of the car and keep driving. When we would stop at a red light, the baby would wake up. When you start driving, they go back to sleep. That flow, motion does that. So when we breathe, your tailbone moves back and forth and rocks and pumps that cerebrospinal fluid. The cranial bones are never stationary. They actually expand and compress and move that. So restriction in the cranium, upper neck, and the tailbone can stop flow of cerebrospinal fluid. Those babies, we adjust them, they can sleep without being rocked.
Wow. I mean, you never think about things like that. You know, I was the driver of the baby, you know, that was it. Wow. I had the exact same thing, but you never think about it. You just think it's like, oh, well, the vibration and the sound, it's just like, you know, lulls them to sleep. Just like, you know, when you become an adult, you listen to white noise because it's probably a throwback to what you experienced as a baby.
Right.
So when it comes to what you've seen in your practice and healthcare in general, of all the wonderful time that we've all had in the past 3 years, has you seen any changes to your practice or what you've observed, thanks to the pandemic?
I mean, yes, because there is so much diversity now and so many opinions flying around, and, you know, more and more people are leaning towards controversial topics and subjects, and politics have gotten big into healthcare and all of that. Now, for one, I'll tell you, the government told all chiropractors to not talk about the immune system during COVID. Because we were legally not allowed to claim that chiropractic adjustment can improve your immune system. So we all stopped. We didn't want to be shut down. Now, one nice thing that happened through the pandemic is the government, federal and state government here in Maryland, deemed chiropractors essential, which was great. But they wanted to keep people out of hospitals. So they said, well, if you have aches and pains, go to the chiropractor instead, because we don't want too many healthy people in hospitals so they could catch the disease. So there were benefits to it and there were drawbacks to it. But yeah, I mean, what the biggest change is patients come in and they, some of them, you know, request that all of us are vaccinated and masked. And some of them come in and say the exact opposite and don't want anything to do with it. And so it's been very political.
Yeah, that's been the tough part. I mean, it seems like things have certainly calmed down. That's for sure. I joke with my audiences when I'm on a certain topic, similar to what this is now. And, you know, just joke, oh, you know, everybody knows that COVID's over, right? Did you hear that? COVID's over now. But it was unfortunately very political as opposed to dealing with the health and wellness of the general population. Which could be frustrating for certain people, depending on what the opinion was, or frustrating for all the above. But are you allowed to say, are we back to you being allowed to say that it improves immunity now? Or are you?
I think so. As long as I premise it the correct way, which is, and you're the expert on this, when the body is in sympathetic overdrive and fight or flight, the two main systems that slow down are digestion and immune system. Because the body wants to focus on muscles and running away. Even the neocortex doesn't get enough blood to it. The blood goes to the primitive centers of the brain. And that's why we can't think as logically when we're in fight or flight. So removing that fight or flight from the body, shifting to rest and repair or parasympathetic, that literally boosts the immune system. And that's how chiropractic does it. Now, the very first federally funded research study on chiropractic, it cost $1 million, which is very little for a medical research study. It was only $1 million, was done by the National Institutes of Health. I believe it was 1991. And they determined that a thoracic spine adjustment will boost the immune system. So this is the federal government who did the study and published it. They found that they would take blood and measure the white blood cell count. Then they would apply an adjustment to the upper thoracic, so upper back, below the neck. And then 15 minutes after the adjustment, they checked the blood again, and all the white blood cells had increased. They called it a respiratory burst. Then they further found out that if you had an overactive immune system, such as allergies or autoimmune, it actually lowered it and normalized it. So it didn't just increase it, it normalized it. And so that's what the study was. So they themselves have said it does boost the immune system. That's public record. It was published. So I think I'm allowed to say chiropractic does boost the immune system.
Well, and I mean, it makes total sense. I mean, you were echoing a lot of what I say during that talk that I mentioned earlier. I mean, I speak of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis and what we need the sympathetic response for, which is a redistribution of resources to ready ourselves for physical survival. So are we in need of those resources when we're sitting at a computer reading cyberbullying, or, you know, in my world, being in the operating room when all hell's breaking loose? We actually need to be in parasympathetic so we can think straight. But it's understandable that most individuals, when they're seeing the monitor, you know, go crazy and the patient's trying to go south on you, it's understandable that you would go into a sympathetic response, but we should take steps to mitigate that so we can think clearly for the reasons you just mentioned, blood flow of, you know, in the brain. So yeah, you're literally echoing a lot of things that I like to talk about. But so moving on to the fact that you've written two books on the stress response, and I would assume stress management and different, you know, do you make suggestions, or, well, let's get general. Tell me about your books.
Okay. The first one I wrote because a lot of people were blaming stress for their illnesses and pains. And I always say the stress is always going to be there. If you want anything in life, it's going to come with stress. You want to have a great marriage, there's going to be stress. There's no stress-free marriage. There's no stress-free parenting. There's no stress-free running a business. You know that. And I wrote the first book, The Stress-Proof Life, for my patients. And that's the one I hand out to every patient that comes in. And it basically, it's how do you put that like a bulletproof vest, except it's a stress-proof vest. So I don't want you to reduce the stress. I just want you to be resilient toward that stress so that the stress hits you, but it doesn't hurt you. So you can thrive. You can keep doing what you're doing. And then the second book that came out last October, Cracking the Stress Secret, How to Turn Pressure into Power. I wrote that more towards the achievers. You know, there's a lot of people. And the way that one started was I was working really hard and I was working on opening another office and pulling a lot of all-nighters. And my dad, before he passed away, he said, "Why do you work so hard? Aren't you worried about your health? You're burning the candle at both ends." And I said, "Dad, you're right. But let me ask you a question." Because what he was saying is, what use is success if it comes at the expense of your health? And he says, "You're 100% right. Success is worthless if it comes at the expense of your health. But let me ask you the opposite. What use is health if it comes at the expense of my hopes, my dreams, my goals, my aspirations, and my future? I can be healthy and be a bum on the street. No disrespect against that. I'm not judging, but I'm just saying, you have to have both. So the second book is the fact that you can have both. You can start a business if you want and maintain your health. You just have to do it correctly. You can go for higher education and grow in your personal development and maintain your health. And there's a way where, you know, I know in your profession, long hours on your feet, you know, just the training to become who you are. And then for you personally, you have a large team that you manage and oversee. Every one of those people on your team adds a level of stress. So the second book, here's the fact. Your health, how healthy you are, is determined by how much stress you can safely handle.
Yeah.
The size of your organization is determined by how much stress you can safely handle. Yeah. And in fact, your income is determined by how much stress you can safely handle. So do you really want to reduce stress? Because reducing stress is turning your back on your goals and dreams and aspirations. Reducing stress is saying, "I want a smaller family. I want a smaller job. I want less of an income." And that's okay if you have to do that for health reasons. But generally, you should go for both. So how do you become stronger? That's what we talked about in this book.
Well, I also feel like you can find a balance between having those goals and wanting to achieve and finding meaning in your life, which can be sometimes a challenge, along with a certain way of living. In other words, you know, well, I work one-on-one with anesthesia residents generally, but also nursing students who are trying to pass the boards. You know, I work with one other gentleman, Dr. Peter Struby, who we work with people trying to pass the boards, in any specialty, really, because it's understandable that you go through these many years of training and it all comes down to one day. If you're a normal human being, you'll exhibit symptoms of extreme stress that day. But it's how we deal with those symptoms that could mean the difference between success and otherwise. So the point of me bringing that up is I'm always talking to these people one-on-one about changing their mindset, reframing the purpose of stress or the idea behind the purpose of stress, and then also reframing this idea of I don't have enough time for this because I have to be doing these all-nighters in the books and everything like that. So my feeling is when you find a balance of, yes, I have to study. Yes, I have to spend many hours on this. But in order for me to be effective at learning and performing, whether it be on a test or in the operating room or in any profession, you have to add these lifestyle choices to that curriculum or consider it as important as the curriculum. And for me, it's exercise, it's meditation, it's breath work. It's, you know, I recommend to all the students, it's a regimen of mindfulness meditation, breathing exercises, and hypnosis. And then I'm always very happy to hear when they say that they're already exercising, you know, things like that. The younger generation seems to be all, you know, already have that figured out. Many more, I think, people in this younger generation that we're working with are exercisers, luckily. And then when you go to the further steps, journaling has become quite an interesting addition to my personal life, which has been way more effective than I ever could have predicted. So I recommend all these types of things for that lifestyle choice to make you more effective at this work that you're trying to achieve, because you obviously want to do it well. So in all of that regard, do you make recommendations on certain like lifestyle choices? And then in addition to that, I mean, is that some of the other information that you address in your books?
100%. I think breathing is extremely powerful. You know that very well. The simple side of breathing is exhale is parasympathetic. And right. So if you have a hard time, just count to five when you breathe in, count to 10 when you exhale, and you shift out of sympathetics. Because when we're scared, what do? We take a breath in and hold it. You know, yeah. We're scared. When you breathe a sigh of relief, yeah. So that's one. Now, there's a couple of things that are controversial in my opinion, my beliefs, which is I wrote in the book, how you eat is more important than what you eat, and how you sleep is more important than how long you sleep. So there are going to be times where you don't have enough time for sleep. But if you do it right, manage the environment correctly, then you can sleep deeper and get the recovery that you need. Short term, that's okay. The reason I said how you eat is more important than what you eat is same thing you were talking about earlier. And the example is the French paradox. In France, people are immune to heart disease and obesity, but they eat wine, cheese, and bread with every meal. So why is it they can eat all this wine, cheese, and bread and not be obese and not have any heart disease? It's because of how they eat. Their bodies are in parasympathetic. They're in rest and repair, rest and digest when they're eating. Well, I stayed in Paris for 3 weeks and hung out with just the locals because I had friends who lived there. And I watched it firsthand. You know, lunch and dinner, they're like sacred acts. You can't rush them. You sit down, you relax, you talk with your friends, you sip, you know, your drink, you eat very, very slow, and you don't schedule your movie or theater tickets right after dinner. Dinner is dinner, theater is theater, and you don't do them together because you don't want to rush through your meal. It literally in kindergarten in the United States, they tell the kids, eat faster, stop talking. In France, they tell the kids, stop eating so fast, talk to your friends. Complete opposite. See, if you've looked at the work of Dean Ornish, that's one of the things he talks about is eat with friends and family, people that you enjoy being around. So as busy as I am, and sounds to me like you're busier than I am, there are times where we only have 15 minutes to eat lunch, maybe even less. The worst thing you can do is shove in the food as fast as possible in a state of sympathetics where the digestion is not ready. The enzymes aren't there. The hormones aren't there. And your body is in a state of fight or flight. That food will sit in your stomach. And that's what indigestion is. It sits in your stomach. It'll ferment. It'll rot. By the time it gets in your intestines, it's not nutritious food. So what I'll do is I'll play some Baroque classical music for, you know, and I'll say a prayer of gratitude. Which is similar to meditation, and get my mind and body ready to receive food, and I'll eat slow. And when my 15 minutes is up, I pack up the food and put it in the fridge because I want to make sure I didn't eat as much as I should, maybe. But the amount that I ate is going to become nutrition in my body. Now, you could put extremely healthy food in me, but I'm in rush hour traffic on the phone with a client or a business associate, and I'm late for my next appointment, and I put really nutritious food in my mouth, that food is going to become poison. It's not going to nourish my body. And sometimes some of these weight loss issues that we have is not because of what we're eating. It's because of how we're eating.
I absolutely love everything you just said about eating, because that is one of my issues as far as all the research and talking that I do about health, wellness, stress management. I personally cannot make sense of all of the information out there about nutrition. And what you just said makes so much sense. It's basically the practice of mindful eating. And when you sit down, you know, you apply the the ideas of mindfulness meditation to eating, it's a totally different practice. Because what do we do when we're eating? We're watching TV, we're watching, you know, the computer, or like you said, we're driving while talking on the phone while trying to operate the stick shift, and you're trying to, you know, shove a Big Mac down so you're not starving at your next meeting, you know. And if you just take the time to stop what you're doing and sit down and pay attention to every bite that's going into your mouth, appreciate the taste and the time, the downtime, you'd get full quicker because you're paying attention to what you're doing. Because how many times do we just, our minds just go elsewhere when we're eating? We're not paying attention to what we're doing. All we're doing is I'm totally guilty of this. I tell a story sometimes because I have a very bad sweet tooth that I would love to get rid of. But there was one time I was home alone. My wife and kids were on a trip, and I just got some delivery, and I saw on the app, I'm like, wow, those cinnamon things look really good. All right. I'm just going to get that, and I'm just going to have one, and you know, I'll put the rest in the fridge. And it came in a huge box, way more than I thought was going to come. And I was just sitting there watching TV. And at one point I was just sitting there watching TV, and I looked down, and the box was in my lap. I looked down and it was empty.
Wow.
I have no memory of consuming this dessert. Like, it was like, I didn't enjoy it. So it's just like, that's a problem. So, And I mean, I've thought about this often. So what you're saying about nutrition just makes so much sense. Even if you, like you say, even if I have a certain amount of time, I'm going to pay attention for that 15 minutes. And if I don't finish, that's fine. I'll finish it later when I do have time to pay attention to it. I think that would be the nutrition information that most people want. Because all of these diets and all this information out there saying you should do this or that, or, you know, intermittent fasting, but this breaks the fast because you're doing, you know, all these new things, all these old things. It's just so much information, and none of it has truly been proven. I mean, there's a lot of new information or research, like legit research out on intermittent fasting, but it's only under certain circumstances are you doing it correctly. And for some people, it doesn't help. So to just pay attention to what you're doing, which is really tough for us in this modern world, I think, makes so much sense.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You can try to comply with all those rules and regulations of intermittent fasting or the ketogenic diet or, you know, all the fads, or you just make sure you are in the right frame of mind and the correct state to receive the food. Now you don't have to be even as strict because your body's in a good state. Why is chronic constipation such a big problem? More than half my patients have constipation. It doesn't make sense, but it's because their nervous system is in fight or flight. And so bowels aren't going to move as fast in that state.
I love the description of the French culture. I've never thought about that before. That's really interesting to me. I mean, that's a good segue. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was talking to somebody yesterday who, now in Spain, everyone goes for a walk after dinner.
Nice.
And that's another one. So a gentleman I was talking to said his father had a heart attack, and the doctor said, you're guaranteed to have another heart attack. So he started walking after every meal, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. He would go for a 30-minute walk. Literally, it reversed all heart disease. And the doctor said, your heart looks like it's 20 years younger than prior to the heart attack.
I am constantly telling people, just move. I'm not telling you get on a treadmill and run for 3 hours till you drop. I'm not telling you that you should be going into a, you know, signing up for a triathlon. Just move. Go for a walk. That's all you need to do. And I going for that walk, it's like people are like, well, that's not exercise, or it's not hard enough. I'm not sweating. My heart rate's not high enough. Well, I just spoke at a conference last week in Manhattan. I was there by myself. I love Manhattan. Over the period of days that I was there, I walked 32 miles and I felt like I was hit by a truck. I truly felt like I had really run a marathon.
Oh, yeah.
It was true hard exercise. And I mean, I had to give myself a couple of days to recover after that, but it was great. So you're exercising when you walk. And if, and then you also get the benefits of being outside. You get the benefits of the fresh air. You get the benefits of the basis of what EMDR is, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. The whole point of EMDR is you're seeing the world go by, and that is a powerful sympathetic suppressor. And I mean, there's so many benefits to it. So another great practice there.
Can I tell you one more thing about walking? Now, if you're pushing a shopping cart or a stroller, that's different. If you're holding a dog leash, that's different. But the cross-crawl pattern that happens in the brain when you walk and swing your arms teaches the right and left hemispheres of your brain to cooperate better, because you move your right arm with the left leg and the left arm with the right leg. Literally, the reason babies are designed to crawl before they walk is so they can connect their two halves of the brain. And kids who don't walk, I'm one of them. I mean, kids who don't crawl, I went straight from sliding on my bottom to grabbing a railing, standing up and walking. I never crawled. I have severe dyslexia. When I wrote these books, I couldn't edit it myself. I had to hire someone to read the book to me so I could edit it over the phone. My eyes can't track across a page because my eyes will jump. If you put subtitled movie in front of me, I'll see the first word, I'll see the last word, I'll see the middle word. And then in my head, I'm trying to rearrange them to make sense of it. By then, it's the next frame. And so very, very powerful brain function improves. It's called species-specific exercise. Humans are made to walk, just like frogs are made to hop. And horses are made to trot. That's the best exercise. Swing your arms when you walk, and everything else falls into place.
Wow, we're getting some gems here. This is good stuff. I mean, again, that makes a lot of sense, even from a standpoint of, again, EMDR. Like one of the techniques of EMDR is the alternate tapping. So if you don't do the eye movement exercises, you can actually cross your arms and tap on your chest with your hands back and forth, which communicates the right and left brain. So all of that makes sense. And that, I mean, that's the basis of all of these research-based interventions that are showing incredible promise for even people with PTSD and depression. So it all makes sense when you get down to the anatomy, physiology, neuroscience, all that stuff. So that stuff, I eat that up. But we can come to a conclusion of how do you take care of yourself?
Well, I start my first minute of the day with exercise, but I do two forms of exercise. One is mobilization and stretching. So when I first wake up, before I do anything else, I go through these spinal exercises, same things I teach my patients on our YouTube channel. YouTube, may I say the YouTube channel?
Yes, please. And I'll put all of the information that you wish into the show notes.
Perfect. It's called Real Chiropractic. And if you go to the exercise templates under playlists, there's template one, template two, template three, and template four. And so that's a progression of spinal exercises that I recommend, and I do those myself. So my first 17 and a half minutes of the day is that spinal health, spinal mobilization. Then I might grab a cup of coffee and do some quiet time, time in prayer, just review my schedule, make sure I know where I need to be and when. After that, I'll eat a nice healthy breakfast and go to the gym. That's when I lift weights. So those are two separate types of exercise. And then I come to the office and see patients or do management and so on. So I think that's what it is. I never rush through a meal. I don't sleep much, which is my problem. I don't have the sweet tooth like you, but I get 6 hours of sleep. Maximum. That's just how my schedule ends up working. I have three sons. I want to be there for them as well. So, but I make sure we cool the house properly. We make the room dark enough, and all of that to make sure that we're producing enough melatonin while we sleep and all of that. So I feel like I get enough. I think healthy would be a little more sleep. Other than that, I do a good job taking care of myself.
Good, good. I that is one of my areas of research is sleep. So we certainly could go down that rabbit hole, but we're it would be another hour. But yeah, I actually, it's funny that you say that because I lecture my chiropractor on the exact same thing. He does not sleep because he has his own practice. He's a single practitioner. He has his own practice. And he is very involved with his kids. His kids are very involved in ice hockey, like family, like involvement. So as soon as he leaves his office, it's ice hockey until they all go to bed. And that's like 7 days a week, 365 days a year. It's like, his kids are like getting set up for the NHL or something. So he is constantly running and being a solo practitioner, he's also got a very busy practice. So everything he does is on his own. He's got his wife helping with office but yeah, so I give him the same talk. It's like, but I mean, he takes very good care of himself too. You can tell just by looking at him, he does a lot of his own exercise and everything like that too. But the one thing I have to give him a hard time about is his amount of sleep. But yeah, I mean, you know, if the rest of you know, what a person is doing is they're, you know, they're cognizant of being healthy and practicing healthy activities. You know, especially in your regard, when it comes to what you've described, 6 hours actually is not that bad, especially if you feel like you're getting through the day without the feeling that you're not, you know, you're sluggish or needing a nap or, you know, that sort of thing.
Here's a quick tip for everybody listening. Research shows a 10-minute nap at 4 p.m. boosts your growth hormone levels.
Yes. Yes. And they say, I mean, because there's two camps when it comes to the sleep experts. One camp says, if you're going to take a nap, take it for 90 minutes so you experience all of the sleep stages. I'm not in that camp because you're going to wake up with something called sleep inertia, which is that drunk feeling of not being able to wake up. And then you immediately go for sugar or caffeine to get out of it. The other camp is take the cat nap, which I do agree with. And all of the benefit, you know, the benefit that you just mentioned, other than the fact that you're going to use up a little bit of the adenosine that's making you feel sleepy. And when you metabolize a little bit of that, you're going to get through the rest of the day and feel less sleepy. So there are many benefits to taking that that cat nap in the afternoon. It's actually a good practice to have. So is that something that you catch yourself doing every once in a while?
I every single day.
Okay,
and I'm very regimented about it. It has to be exactly 10 minutes. So I set the alarm for 10 minutes. And usually it's not enough to go into a deep sleep, which is I don't want to be in a deep sleep because of sleep inertia, like you mentioned. And I don't want to increase cortisol levels or anything like that. I just want to rest. So in the old days, they called it a beauty rest.
Right.
Because the growth hormone goes up, you don't get wrinkles and your muscles stay supple and bones don't get osteoporotic. So,
have you heard of NSDR? Non-sleep deep rest.
I'm not familiar with it though.
It's something that Andrew Huberman talks a lot about. Everybody knows him. It's interesting that we live in an era where we have celebrity scientists now, which is pretty cool.
It's amazing.
He talks about it because he does it every day. And it's basically just exactly how it sounds. You basically get yourself to where you give yourself some time and you coach yourself down into physical relaxation, heads relaxed, shoulders relaxed, you know, and coach yourself down. And you get yourself to the point of right before you fall asleep, but don't. Now, if you fall asleep, that's fine because you needed it. But if you get yourself right to that point of complete relaxation, right to that edge of sleep, but you still stay awake, the benefits there are incredible. And some say, and he says the same benefit as that nap. And he gets into the neuroscience of everything that's good that happens when you do it, but it's almost this, I mean, it's pretty much the same as getting into a very deep, meditation or a very deep hypnotic, experience or something like that as well. But at the same time, very easy to actually fall well within that realm of sleep as well, you know, if you needed it. So.
Right.
But something That's interesting amazing. There.
Wonderful.
But well, Amir, we have reached an hour very, very quickly. I just want to say thank you very much for your time. This has been really interesting. I love talking about the subject that we just covered, especially with an expert such as yourself. I love the the other perspectives that you brought to the subject. I actually look forward to looking into a few things that you mentioned. As I always do with all of these discussions, I always give my guest an opportunity for a final thought. So if you would like to, please do so.
Absolutely. I mean, bottom line is who you are determines how well what you do works. So become the kind of person who can tolerate the stress. Become the kind of person who can go after your dreams. Become the kind of person. See, there's two schools of thoughts. One says, I don't smoke. The other says, I am a non-smoker. One person says, I smoke. One person says, I am a smoker. It's your identity. What is your identity? Watch what you're saying, because who you are, again, determines how well what you do works. Become the person you want to be first, and everything else will work better for you.
Very good. That's very well put. Thank you very much. Again, I really appreciate your time, and I'll look forward to keeping in touch. And this was great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So that'll do it for this episode. I hope to see you at the next one. This is Matthew Zinder and the Provider Wellness Podcast. Please stay safe and stay well.